At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Oh, Canada. See what I did there? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, the 13th of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was at the White House today. Standard deal, photo op and handshake in those chairs in the Oval Office in front of the fireplace, joint press conference afterward, opening statements and a couple of questions to each side. Boom, done. The big economic elephant in the room, NAFTA, didn't come up until the questions started. President Trump said the United States has a, quote, very outstanding trade relationship with Canada, end of quote, while, and quoting again, on the southern border for many, many years, the transaction was not fair to the United States. It was an extremely unfair transaction, end of quote. Trudeau, once he started, said NAFTA is a real concern for many Canadians because their jobs depend on trade with the United States and that a lot of American jobs depend on American exports up to Canada. So, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports now on the role that Canada might play as it tries to save NAFTA.
Canada wants to keep NAFTA alive. It says jobs on both sides of the border are at stake. Canada's pitch goes something like this.
And there are 9 million jobs in America that depends directly on the trade with Canada.
That's Jean-Claude Lauzon. He's a diplomat at the Quebec government office in New York. He says Canada could be a mediator between the U.S. and Mexico if NAFTA were renegotiated.
The role of Canada around the world has always been one of a very open mind. And if we can put that on the table to help, we will gladly do so.
But why would Canada want to put itself in the middle? Matt Gold is a former Deputy Assistant U.S. Trade Representative. He says Canada and Mexico realize Trump may try to pit them against each other.
What President Trump is doing is a classic divide and conquer.
So Gold says Canada and Mexico could band together.
They see themselves as being able to benefit from a coordinated series of tactics.
But that doesn't mean Canada doesn't have its own agenda, says Michael Froman, a former U.S. trade representative, now at the Council on Foreign Relations. He says here's what Canada would want if it ended up negotiating on its own with the U.S. if NAFTA were killed.
Canada has always resented our Buy America policies. You could expect that Canada would come to the table wanting access to government procurement in the U.S.
And Froman says Canada will continue to stress how many U.S. jobs depend on exports to the North, especially in the Midwest states that helped Trump win in November. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Here's an education policy phrase that got a lot of traction in the Obama years: gainful employment. Rules to make sure that graduates of mostly for-profit career education programs earn enough money to be able to repay their federally guaranteed student loans. Which gets us to Betsy DeVos, now less than a week into her new job as the Secretary of Education. The American Association of Cosmetology Schools is suing the secretary to block enforcement of the gainful employment rules. Might be helpful here to know, just as background, that in the first year of those regulations, about 60% of cosmetology and barbering programs did not meet the new standards. From the Education Desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
As a hairstylist in Richmond, Kentucky, Brittany Himes makes minimum wage plus tips, sometimes a little more with commissions.
It's up in the air. You never really know what you're going to bring home every week.
That makes it tough to pay off the $20,000 she borrowed for cosmetology school. Himes graduated from a Paul Mitchell school in Lexington in 2013.
I'm really glad that I did the program and did it there, but I don't feel like it was maybe worth $20,000.
According to the Department of Education, that program is one of hundreds whose graduates don't earn enough to justify their student debt, meaning the program could lose eligibility for federal financial aid. Attorney Edward Cramp with Duane Morris represents the beauty school trade group suing the department. He says the government relies on the income reported to the Social Security Administration.
And unfortunately, in these licensed professions, a lot of the transactions are done in cash, and it's hard for people to accurately report their income every year.
That's a nice way of saying that a lot of people underreport their tips. But Ben Miller with the Center for American Progress says earnings aren't the only issue.
The big difference is the debt, that essentially the programs that failed to pass gainful employment have debt levels about two times the level at which a program passes.
Miller says beauty schools need to find ways to make their offerings more affordable, and states should look at licensing requirements that may keep students in school longer than necessary. The Department of Education declined to comment on the lawsuit today, and it's not clear whether the Trump administration plans to enforce the gainful employment rules. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
One quick item before we move on. Apple shares in the computer maker turned, really, mobile phone company closed at their highest point in more than a year today on optimism about the coming 10th anniversary iPhone, which is coming, one imagines, soonish. Elsewhere in market-based capitalism, all good. In the major indices, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. So it turns out there may actually be a thing or two that economists can learn from English majors, which is not saying that one is better than the other, but students of literature, it is widely recognized, are well trained to spot narratives. And now, maybe more than ever, the economy is being affected by the prevailing story that is getting all the buzz. Robert Shiller is a professor of economics at Yale University. His paper earlier this year was called Narrative Economics. Professor, thanks for coming on the program.
My pleasure.
First thing I think we need, sir, is a sort of a three-sentence description of what you mean by narrative economics.
Narratives are talked about by a lot of journalists, social scientists, but not particularly by economists. What is a narrative? It's a kind of gem of conversation that gets repeated again and again. It goes viral. It changes people's perspectives, their norms, their scripts, and changes people's behavior. Economists should pay more attention to these narratives. If you want to know why things happen, why did we have the great financial crisis? Why did we have the Great Depression? Questions like that are not satisfactorily answered by economists because they don't pay attention enough to narratives.
Why? I mean, you've been an economist for a good long while. Why do you suppose it is that economists have not paid attention to the stories, I guess, that are going on out there?
First of all, some of them do. I think some of the best of them do. Also, our policymakers, people who actually have to meet the real world, they intuitively pay attention to narratives. So, for example, in the recent financial crisis, 2007 to 2009, the old narrative about bank runs, which had been forgotten, was coming back. And our banking authorities decided, we are not going to have a bank run. We'll bail them out. This was contrary to a lot of political thinking. It didn't seem right, but they did it because instinctively they knew we don't want to renew that Depression-era narrative.
Okay, but here's the thing, and you say this in your paper, narratives are inherently subjective. The way we perceive the stories that we're told vary on an individual basis.
Yeah, and this is another reason why economists feel uncomfortable about talking about narratives. it sounds a little bit unscientific. They leave it for people like you, yeah. Journalists. But I think, you know, they're not incompatible, actually. We can do statistical analysis of narratives, but we shouldn't get too carried away. Ultimately, narratives are human phenomena that require judgment. You have to judge what the narrative is and why it influences thinking. But still, I think economists can do it, and I think increasingly they are.
The thing that's interesting about the Trump narrative, though, that we're in the middle of, is that if you look at how it's being perceived by a lot of people, you know, consumer confidence is up, the stock market is up, many indicators are trending in a positive direction based on this narrative.
The narrative that Donald Trump has invented, and we got to give him credit, he's a genius at narratives. It comes out of a public image that he's developed over a long time, notably his Apprentice TV show, mm-hmm. which began over 10 years ago. That was a narrative presenting him as a mentor, the real thing, because he himself appears to be a big success in business. Tough guy. He comes at a time when people think that we need a tough guy. That's the really thing you have to appreciate about narratives. They survive because they are contagious, because they attract attention. Trump is kind of a unique person because there aren't that many billionaires who have the narrative concept down so firmly.
Robert Shiller is a Nobel Prize winning economist. He is Sterling Professor of Economics at Yale University. His paper is called Narrative Economics. Thanks very much for your time, sir.
Kai, thank you. My pleasure.
We mentioned before on this program, I believe, the retirement savings crisis we're facing in this country. Some studies put the number of Americans who don't have enough in their retirement accounts to maintain their current standards of living to be as high as 6 in 10. Many people don't have any retirement savings at all, and to make matters worse, those who do save routinely dip into their retirement accounts. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has the second of two stories now on the personal finance dynamics of putting a little bit away every month.
Dear America, we are bad at saving.
For every dollar that people are contributing to the retirement savings system, about 40 cents of that money is coming out before people reach their late 50s.
Bridget Madrian is professor of public policy at Harvard.
That's a quite striking amount of leakage, especially when many people are not saving enough for retirement in the first place.
By the way, raiding your retirement account is usually a really bad idea, according to most experts.
Essentially, what you're doing is you're cutting yourself off at the knees.
Jane DeLashmet O'Mara is a portfolio manager at FBB Capital Partners.
You cut yourself out of all of the opportunity for future growth.
Now, of course, life happens. People buy homes, people get sick, people have crises. But big picture, one reason we are so bad at saving? Bridget Madrian again?
Because it requires giving up something today for something in the very, very distant future that is somewhat uncertain. And we're hardwired to prefer immediate gratification.
Starting to save is also a difficult and complicated decision.
And there are a lot of things that people have to decide. How much to save? What kind of an account do I put the money in? What kind of an investment allocation?
You know what's a lot easier than making these decisions? Just la-la-la-la-la, not making them, which is why economists have come to the conclusion that to get people to save, we kind of need to trick ourselves into doing it.
We were trying to work with low-income consumers to help them improve their savings rates.
Dilip Soman is professor of management at University of Toronto, and he did not technically trick anyone, I should say that, but he did do a neat experiment. He had workers in India paid weekly salaries with a part of their paychecks set aside in envelopes.
Half the cases, people just got one envelope with the designated savings amount in it. In the other half of the cases, the same amount was split equally across two envelopes.
3 months later, a lot of people had raided their savings envelopes. But the people with two savings envelopes had saved 64% more than the people with just one envelope.
The act of partitioning any resource dramatically slows down the rate of consumption.
Here's an analogy.
Imagine somebody gave you a large bag of popcorn versus somebody gave you the same quantity of popcorn in four smaller bags. Would you eat different amounts? And the answer is yes, because with the large bag, you basically make one decision to open the bag.
One tasty decision to gorge.
But with four separate bags, every time you finish one bag, you now have another decision to make. And so that's exactly what's happening with the savings envelopes.
Soman was able to crank up the savings rates another 20% by putting photos of the employees' kids on the envelopes.
Guilt plays a huge role.
Some researchers think employers should set up automatic rainy day funds for their employees, sort of like this envelope study. And some banks are toying with the idea, right down to the picture of your kid gimmick. Bruce Wolf is a managing director at BlackRock, and he is actually not convinced.
And my initial reaction is we're adding another layer of complexity. You know, the more confusing and complicated you make things, the lower the probability that they will be used as initially intended.
Maybe, but these sorts of tricks, and really they're more like brain hacks, are increasingly popping up in our savings system. Some employers automatically sign workers up for 401k plans. Some plans automatically increase the amount deducted from paychecks over time. It's all about avoiding complex, difficult decisions. The bottom line is that sometimes our number one enemy when it comes to saving, as with so many things, is ourselves. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The road is still dumb.
But not for long. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 142 points today, 0.7%, 20,412. The NASDAQ up 29 points, about 0.5%, 52.55. The S&P 500 gained 12 points, about 0.5%, 23.28. The price war among the big U.S. mobile phone carriers is heating up. Verizon announced today it's going to once again offer an unlimited data plan. Verizon down 0.9%. Rivals lost as well. T-Mobile off 2%. AT&T dropped about 1.7%. Allergan, the company that makes Botox, has placed a big bet on the so-called cash pay cosmetics business, procedures insurers don't cover. Allergan agreed to pay almost 2.5 billion simoleons for Zeltiq Aesthetics. The deal gives Allergan a product it claims helps people lose weight by freezing the fat away. Okay. Allergan gained 0.1%. Zeltiq rose 13.2% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.43%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everybody. Molly here.
It's Kai, but you already knew that.
You did. But we have something that we would like to tell you together.
We are doing a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, about the things we want to know more about but don't always have time to dig into on this daily program.
Yeah, and it's about you, too, the things that you want to know more about and the things that you're an expert on. We'd like to have you on the show, too.
And mostly it's me and Molly having fun. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart. There's lots more info there.
And please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you podcast.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The cutthroat business of network television is ramping up right now, getting ready for what is called pilot season, that time of year when new shows are pitched and shot, if they're lucky, and programming decisions are made. Some shows will make it, most won't. And in this era of streaming and peak TV and so very much content, who's in and who's out is a harder call to make than ever before. We've got our entertainment correspondent Adrian Hill here to get us up to speed on shows we might never really see and also what producers for the small screen are up to. Hey.
Hey, Guy.
So as we saw, I think, during the Super Bowl, right, this is an interesting time to be programming television. Forget ads. What do you do now if you're trying to do, like, content and TV and stuff?
Well, content and TV for everyone. That's the trick for these networks, right? They don't get the luxury of niche stuff. So there are a couple things. If you read the trades, you're going to notice out there. One is the shows that are going to hit you over the head with just how obvious they are. So we've got a show about refugees resettling in the U.S., but they're refugees from U.S. of the future.
Yeah. I can't even get my brain
wrap your head around that one. A small town Kentucky sheriff who has to work with a Muslim FBI agent to solve crime.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
An African American cop and a Pakistani cop also have to work together. You want to just sing "Kumbaya" with
me
right now?
Wow.
Yeah.
What else are you seeing?
So there are other ways the studios are sort of trying to get to middle America, I think. There I think almost all the networks, three of the big four, have military-themed shows right now, trying to tap into the sort of patriotic American sentiment that, that both sides were trying to really grab during the election. There's some religious shows in the works, a comedy and a light drama.
That's always dicey, right? I mean,
it'll be interesting to see. And again, these may not show up in the fall. They could fall flat during sort of while they shoot these pilots once they actually see what they've got. There are a couple of shows focused on working class families, but not as many as I was sort of looking for. And one of my favorites here, Kai, you know, you would never guess this one. What? We've got a show about a rapper who runs for political office and wins.
No, we don't. You're making that up. No. Seriously?
Yeah. Yeah. Not at all on the nose. Man. Not at all on the nose. But, you know, it brings me to like this other trick this year, right? If you're doing a political show, especially, but really all TV, how do you, in the world do you make something as entertaining, if I can use that word, as what's going on MSNBC and CNN and Fox News? The drama is so intense in real life. How do you compete with that?
That can't be it, right? I mean, there's got to be more out there than just politics and you know, I mean, what?
And come together.
Right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the networks are really going heavy in on the stuff they do well, which is the escapist stuff, the procedurals, the medical dramas, the goofy family comedies, because at the end of the day, like, don't you just want to like,
I do. That's
tune
what
out?
I want to do.
That's and what that's what these networks are good at. And there's a lot of money going into those shows this year.
Adrian Hill covers entertainment for us. Thanks.
Thanks, Guy.
Cars, while they, at least for now, still do need a human behind the wheel, are getting smarter and more sophisticated all the time. Roads, though, dumber than a box of rocks. Actually, they are rocks, right? Pretty much just pavement and that's it. But with the autonomous vehicle handwriting on the wall, states are beginning to turn highways into high-tech laboratories for everything from traffic management to environmental sustainability. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, Bradley George reports.
Allie Kelly sits on a concrete bench outside a rest area along I-85 in western Georgia, near the Alabama state line, as cars and trucks whoosh by at 70 miles an hour.
The road is still dumb.
Kelly works for the Ray C. Anderson Foundation, which funds environmental projects. It's spent about $500,000 to make this highway smarter. Some of that money has gone to test solar panels in a roadside rest stop, and a system for drivers to check tire pressure without leaving their cars. And there are plans for drones and sensors to monitor traffic and roadside channels filled with plants that will purify storm runoff.
We want to demonstrate to the world that transportation can go zero carbon. We also want to prove to the world that we can go zero deaths. We want to become more efficient. We want to unlock value in our system of roads and system of right-of-way.
Later this year, the foundation will install a solar farm in the median and shoulders of the interstate.
Part of our partnership is to learn and to try and to innovate such that we can deploy this outside of this corridor on Interstate 85 and potentially to the rest of the state and hopefully to the nation as well.
Russell McMurray is commissioner of the Georgia Department of Transportation. While the Anderson Foundation comes up with ideas for the I-85 project, his agency provides technical expertise.
We have our normal day jobs to do, and you know, we don't have just you know, extra staff sitting around saying what if. But it's a challenge. You know, it's having them to help challenge us to be innovative and think about things differently.
Other states are starting similar initiatives. Missouri wants to turn Interstate 70 into what it calls a road to tomorrow, which would use some of the same technologies in the Georgia project. Ohio, Utah, and Virginia are embedding sensors that can communicate with vehicles about traffic and road conditions. Bob Skinner is the former chairman of the Transportation Research Board, a program of the National Academy of Sciences. He says states and engineers have always looked for ways to improve roads, but that effort is starting to accelerate in anticipation of the day drivers will share the road with driverless cars.
We're going to have a whole host of operational questions about
operating highways with both autonomous vehicles and non-autonomous vehicles. What sort of delineation, roadside markers, stripes on the side of roads and so forth, what sort of features will aid the vehicles in self-navigation?
California is already taking steps to prepare for driverless vehicles. The state is also looking for ways to make road construction greener. Kome Ajise of the California Department of Transportation says his agency wants to use more environmentally friendly materials, such as concrete made with reclaimed ash from coal power plants. But many contractors are reluctant.
There are implications for a larger market, because the contractors that work in our market also work in other states, and so we're making sure that we're not doing something that puts them at a disadvantage.
All of this is happening as state governments try to figure out how to pay for their current road needs. Many have raised gas taxes. In Atlanta, I'm Bradley George for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, not all great jurisprudence happens in the high-profile cases, you know. From the United States Court of International Trade last Friday, a decision in case number 130039 or 5, All-Star Marketing Group LLC versus United States, in which was held, and I'm not making this up, that Snuggies are in fact blankets, that the addition of sleeves is not so substantial as to transform said Snuggie into something other than a blanket, and that therefore it was so ordered that subject import, that is, the Snuggies, are properly classified under Tariff Provision 6301.40.00 of the Harmonized Tariff Schedule of the United States and tariffed, yes, that's a word, at 8.5% as plaintiff All-Star Marketing LLC had wanted, not the 14.9% that defendant United States had suggested. And also, who says business and economic news is boring, huh? I personally never understood the whole Snuggie thing, but that could just be me. All right, we're out of here. The Dow up 142.7%. The NASDAQ up 29.5%. S&P 500 gained 12.5% there as well. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonder, Robert Gorova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.